Welcome to State Theory Live. Today, they're carrying on an intellectual conversation with Professor Catherine Hales. Professor Hales is a professor of literature and media at UCLA, and she's the author of three really original, intellectually compelling, and I think really books of great historical importance in terms of naming the cultures in which we live. The three books are Writing Machines, How We Became Posthuman, and her most recent, or one of her most recent texts, which is My Mother's Computer. The interview is conducted between Los Angeles, UCLA in Los Angeles, and Sea Theory, which is located in the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Catherine, thank you very much for doing this interview, and welcome to Sea Theory Live.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Yeah, it's really great, and really is really wonderful to have a chance to have a conversation with you on your this wonderful trilogy of books that you've come out with, Writing Machines, How We Became Posthuman, and My Mother Was a Computer, which are really, I think, really quite remarkable. Because, you know, as you read through these books, you say, well, these are like just sort of ground-shaking books in the history of contemporary intellectuality. You deal with issues of electronic textuality, you develop really a new method of media-specific analysis. You begin with a really unrelenting critique of liberal human subjectivity, and then suddenly, through a history of cybernetics, it becomes a history of a new mode of being itself. And then more than anything, the books are just leavened with not just a theoretical discussion of intermediation, such concepts as intermediation or the new materialism of the relationships between speech and writing and code, but in fact are just actually vivid, eloquent description of how intermediation actually works. How, in fact, digital subjects relate to literary texts. So, really, just with that as a way of an introduction, I wonder if, Catherine, you'd sort of talk about the trajectory of these three books taken together from your perspective.
Well, I, of course, didn't know that I was going to write a trilogy when I wrote the first book, How We Became Posthuman, but looking back on it from the retrospective of having written all three books, it was clear to me that they were more or less an interrelated series of meditations on the same questions and issues. So it began for me with the realization that there really was no interpretive history of cybernetics. There was Steve Heim's wonderful book, The Cybernetics Group, which is deeply researched, but from my point of view, under-theorized. And I was interested in contemporary claims from people like Hans Moravec that we would soon be able to upload the body into a computer, which seemed to me profoundly mistaken. And to try to unravel the history of how ideas like that became possible, I found myself going back to the formation of cybernetics in the immediate post-World War II period, and was making the argument that a disembodied theory of information formulated by Shannon and Weaver was in fact conceptually inferior to Donald McKay's embodied theory of information, but won out because it could be easily quantified, while McKay's could not. But then, having been formulated as a disembodied and meaningless, that is, idea of information that had no connection with meaning, that idea then rapidly spread to a whole variety of other fields that are deeply enmeshed in meaning, like communication theory, semiotics, etc., and began to authorize this idea that information was an immaterial entity that could flow effortlessly between one substrate and another, which is then a direct lineage to Moravec's idea that we could upload human consciousness into a computer. So in part then, I was trying to introduce embodiment back into the picture. And in part, I was trying to trace the implications of this for subjectivity.
Catherine, really sorry, could you hold on a moment? Because right behind you, someone's dialed into the video conferencing system. Right in the middle of your thought, too. I'm really sorry about this. This is from UCLA's end.
Oh, yeah. Now she's back.
Catherine, this is going to be a real test for your intellectuality. you've been rudely interrupted.
I hope we could somehow splice things together.
This is a test of not the metaphor, but the splice.
Well, in any event, I was interested in tracing how we could put embodiment back into the picture while not neglecting the effect on subjectivities of this disembodied notion of information. And having explored that and how we became post-human, it then seemed to me I should take those lessons onto my home ground of literary studies and talk about texts as embodied entities. And that led to the second book in the trilogy, Writing Machines, where I was developing the idea of media-specific analysis that would be attentive to the material mode in which the texts were instantiated. And since computation is looming larger and larger in our contemporary world, the third book, My Mother Was a Computer, was then an attempt to extend those ideas into both a theoretical and interpretive practice that would talk about intermediation as the interaction of language and code, of print and electronic textuality, and analog and digital modes of transmission.
Yeah, that's a really eloquent description, and I like how you were able to do this place perfectly. So it was great. So, Catherine, can I just take you back for a moment then? Because, you know, when you read your work, like, really, all, you know, it comes to mind C.V. Snow's images of two solitudes, the engineer and the artist, and this lack of mediation between the two. So when I really reflected on your work, I thought, well, that's actually not true. Actually, you're like C.V. Snow in reverse image in some ways, because you haven't stopped simply the discussion of the scientist and the artistic imagination, but in fact, you've really begun with your books like On the Cosmic Web and Chaos and Order. You've really begun with the theory of complexity theory itself, and have driven, as you say in Writing Machines, complexity theory writing. Well, you don't quite say this, but my interpretation of what you say, you've driven complexity theory right into the neocortex of literary theory itself. And by extension, maybe we could talk about it a moment, into a really profoundly new vision, transformative vision of human culture. So I wonder if you could just talk about complexity theory, which is the science.
Well, complexity theory is very much bound up with these ideas, because complexity is about multi-agent, multi-causal situations, which of course describes almost all of the social world and much of the biological world as well. And chaos theory kind of evolved into complexity theory, but then a very strong component of both chaos theory and complexity theory was the idea that you could simulate these processes in a computer. And in My Mother Was a Computer, I talk about the ways in which simulation science is actually transforming central concepts like what counts as an explanation, and what counts as agency, what counts as causality. And there are really significant differences between how those issues look if you're talking about a simulation versus an explicit mathematics that can give you an explicit answer formulated through equations. So it seems to me that computation is really shifting the ground of science as well as, of course, literature and a variety of other fields as well.
Yeah, so really great. So would it be fair to say that really in terms of your original interest in complexity theory, and I'm thinking of like the cosmic web when you discuss, you know, really force fields and really by implication relativity theory, and then you go on to describe the novels of Pynchon and Nabokov as literary equivalents of these, you know, like places where in fact the principles of a new quantum science are being worked out. Would it be fair to say that what begins as like a history of cybernetics and a real interest in complexity theory really quickly and imminently through all of your texts quickly becomes like a real critique of the liberal humanist subject, which you begin to view, you know, as like a subject which is operating under the illusions of an autonomous self, bounded borders on one hand, and really operating always with the illusion of having an embedded consciousness as opposed to the notion of consciousness that's really about distributed cognition and neural networks and things like this.
Yes, I think that's very much the case, that historically the idea of the liberal humanist subject which was accompanied by notions of free will, autonomy, rationality, consciousness as the seat of identity, and so forth, was deeply bound up with causal explanations in science. It was a science that was equipped to deal with a world in which there were weak or negligible interactions between different bodies, particles, etc. And so you can see how that notion translates into the idea of an autonomous self possessed of rationality and free will. So those ideas, those paradigms grew up together, they mutually reinforced each other, and as much as those scientific ideas contributed to knowledge and technology and so forth, their weak point was always not being able to deal very effectively with complex systems. And so in a certain sense, the interactions between literature and science followed the causal models to explain interactions between literature and science followed the same general trajectory. In the early part of the 20th century, the dominant model to explain interactions between science and literature were causal and linear. They went from science to influence literature. And people like Marjorie Hope Nicholson did important work following that paradigm, but obviously it is applicable only to a very small percentage of the kind of complex interactions that take place between literature and science. So I think that these ideas of how the dynamics of complex systems work is applicable not only to explain social systems and the natural world, but also different disciplinary formations, like in my case, literature and scientific fields as well. It's distributed. Yeah. It relies on a whole infrastructure of extended cognition. It's multi-causal and intensely recursive.
Right. And so would it be accurate to say then, really, like out of the rubble of liberal human subjectivity, that really all of your work in some way or another is beginning to touch on and beginning to formulate the contours, the developing contours of a theory of complex human subjectivity?
Yes, I think that's fair to say, and it's what I see as the positive contribution that notions like the post-human and literature as a computational practice can contribute. There are, of course, many aspects of the post-human that I would like to resist, but I also think it has positive potential, and its positive potential is a deeper realization of what complexity means across a variety of fields.
So those resistances are, this is a good psychoanalytic question, you know, really.
Obviously, I'm resistant to many brands of what's called transhumanism, the idea that a singularity is approaching that will profoundly transform the conditions of human life, and of course that's deeply tied in with the notion of uploading as well. Yeah. Not that I doubt the conditions of human life are transforming, it's just that I want to resist this kind of apocalyptic notion that suddenly we're going to be transformed into different kinds of creatures, which I think goes against everything biologists actually know about what it means to be an embodied human subject.
Yeah. And the other resistances?
Well, I think that much of the discourse of transhumanism is driven by a fear of mortality, which I think needs to be examined. These longings for immortality and a kind of transcendent subject that can be immortal and not be limited by any physical constraints. I think those are deeply flawed notions that really have to be looked at very carefully.
Yeah, and Catherine, would you? It's really great. And would you also say that perhaps, like you're writing, in some ways, is like a gentle resistance? You know, a gentle but very firm resistance also against what you might view as extreme forms of post-humanism. And then think of like Jean Baudrillard, and because like My Mother Was a Computer, you're operating in a very similar territory, eh? Like, Baudrillard begins his writing with Le Système des Objets, and he's going back to the writings of Saussure, to the science system. You come back to the same writings, to structuralism, and it's a very different take on the same author itself. Because where Baudrillard focuses on the notion that the sign, in fact, at some point just becomes a history of pure virtuality, like a not even a flickering signifier, but an oscillating signifier, like a hyperreality. You, in fact, come back to it and say, no, we need like a much more mediated materialist description of signification itself. And you almost see in your work what will be a future history written under this form of structuralism of the history of technology.
I think that's correct, and my early training as a scientist marked me psychologically and conceptually deeply, and so I always like to ground any explanation that I offer in material practice and material entities. So I'm a little suspicious of theorizing that doesn't have that kind of grounding, though I find Baudrillard stimulating to read. There's a kind of giddiness about some of his later writing in particular that that is very different than the kind of sensibility I bring to this work.
But curiously, you know, when I was reading your work and I was actually thinking of Baudrillard, and I actually went back and began to reread Baudrillard again. So I was reading your work, like, you have one line in My Mother Was a Computer, and I'm not quoting accurately, but it's pretty close. When you say, in fact, when you discuss the difference between hyper-reality and reality, we can sort of forget that description, because in fact all of reality now has become hyper-reality. I think, well, Catherine's become Baudrillard.
Well, yes, you are more or less quoting correctly, and in fact, I would like to claim that postmodernism as a descriptive and theoretical term began to lose its purchase around 1995. In fact, in April 1995, when the first viable version of Netscape browser was introduced, because the sort of shock that accompanied postmodernism, and I include in that Baudrillard the sort of sense of shock, I think has now just become mundane reality. And so many people continue to use the term postmodernism. I regard it as an epoch in our society and in theoretical development that ended about 1995 to be succeeded by something else. And there are different names for what that something else is. You could call it the post-human, you could call it the regime of computation as I have, or there are other terms other people use. But I think it is distinctively different than the classic and seminal texts of postmodernism.
Well, that's pretty good. And so this regime of computation, would have anything about it of the terrorism of the code?
The terrorism of the code.
Yeah.
Hmm. Well,
This is an ungrounded question, but it's really grounded in actual political events which go on today.
Yes. Well, it is quite true that in computationally intense cultures such as Canada, the U.S., other Western and also Asian cultures like Japan, machine-to-machine communication has now progressed to the point where it's about 99% of all coded traffic. And most of that traffic takes place outside human awareness, so that human awareness is the tiny tip of a pyramid of a huge amount of data flow, most of which happens between machines. And so there is a very unsettling aspect to that, revealed, for example, in the U.S. by Bush's surveillance policy. But that's only one small part of what's going on. And the fact that nobody knows what most of those communications are, it's not even the NSA knows what most of those communications are, gives one pause. And it raises profound questions about the proper relation of human awareness to all of these coded transmissions.
Yeah. So, Catherine, do you think it's, in terms of the regime of computation, you've said in My Mother Was a Computer, which is really, I just view as such an elemental, fundamental text. It's really an important, important book for everybody to read. And but I was like I had this niggling, I'm a metaphysician at heart, you know, really. It's my Heidegger training. And so I was pretty curious on page 52. I'll give you the quote. You say, "Moreover, the historical strata of code do not involve a troublesome metaphysical inheritance, but a troublesome deeper layer of a deep layer of a similar code that can be understood and reverse engineered only with great difficulty." Now, the reason I found that troubling, in fact, is because I just kept going back to thinking back to Heidegger, where Heidegger would say that, you know, when you live metaphysically most, in fact, in the presence of a culture which denies that it has anything about metaphysics about it. And I was just wondering if, in fact, the regime of computation has really effaced the troublesome history of metaphysics, or if, in fact, it represents the completely realized history of metaphysics, which would move, as Heidegger says, in two directions. One direction, I think you've so brilliantly and eloquently articulated, which is a regime of computation, and then under the impact of, you know, you turn to Deleuze and Guattari's notions of, you know, works of assemblage and rhizomatic structures. You just found really transformative ways of describing a new embedded form of materialism operating in texts, forms of digital subjectivity. But on the other hand, perfectly in balance with that and equally powerful would be, as you've just described, regimes of computation which have to do with surveillance cultures and nefarious uses of the net. I mean, you're savage in your descriptions of Microsoft Corporation, for example. You know, you describe them as predatory capitalism and things like this. And I noticed in My Mother is a Computer also that your mind is really attentive to this because, you know, there's so many sentences where it's questions of ideology, software as ideology, questions of class, racial, divisions, and also the question of, you know, the implications for gender, of liberal human subjectivity begin to pop up again and again. So is it possible, in fact, you know, unconsciously, that Heidegger's notion of this completely realized culture of technology having opposite tendencies has begun, in fact, to emerge in your writings?
Well, understood in that sense, I would certainly agree with that. And I would certainly agree with Wendy Chung's claim that software is ideology. She cites Althusser's definition of ideology, and it's perfectly fits software. That is a sort of formation that is affecting the subject of which the subject is unaware. And that's exactly the case with contemporary software. So I agree with all of that, and I don't altogether mean to say that metaphysics is absent from the regime of computation, because many of the claims by people like Ed Fredkin that there is a universal computer are unsubstantiable. That is, in a strict scientific sense, they can't be falsified. Therefore, they're not really scientific or physical claims. They're ideological or metaphysical claims. So in that sense, too, I think the regime of computation is profoundly metaphysical, although it's shifting the ground of traditional metaphysics.
In which ways?
Well, instead of, for example, mathematics being the language of nature, which the Pythagoreans deeply believed and which has been a kind of staple of the scientific worldview up until mid-20th century, now computation is understood as the language of nature. So that is a kind of metaphysical claim. It's, again, one could never substantiate that in detail, but to believe that that is the case then makes computation a very different kind of enterprise than it would be if it didn't have that sort of deep authority that this is how nature herself works.
Yeah. So, and that would account then for your, like, at the beginning of My Mother's Computer, which, you know, those really eloquent first chapters in which you circle around the writings of Saussure and Derrida. And the context for it is your description of the movement from inhuman culture, from speech to writing to code. And you say just as much as, you know, Saussure is making the argument for flickering signifiers and the supremacy of speech over writing, Derrida comes along and begins to speak of, the privilege rights of writing itself, with deferral and questions of supplementarity. over the and the trace over the question of right over the question of speech itself. And then Catherine Hales comes along and begins to, in fact, say, no, in fact, we've gone through a great ontological and epistemic rupture. In fact, we have entered the age of code, the age of computation itself. And that has an ambivalent relationship with Derrida and Saussure, and opens up your writings to Deleuze and Guattari, which is, seems to be a real influence, I would think, in such a creative way.
Well, that's right. And I was interested in beginning to explore what happens if you put code as a language system in juxtaposition with Saussurean linguistics and Derridean grammatology. And for me, the kind of generative difference that code introduces into that picture is the realization that code, as I say, has two addressees, humans and intelligent machines. And the necessity to mediate between these addressees is deeply influential and explains almost everything about the way that code is structured, its architecture, its performance, and its processual nature.
Yeah. So, and it would also, that would also mean, though, that the regime of computation moves you beyond the age of the logos with its language of presence and absence to, in fact, patterns which you begin to describe when you describe them, for example, in How We Became Posthuman, the regime of autopoiesis leading to emergence, the notion of randomness and pattern, really, as the oscillation of culture within which we live. And speaking, it's almost perfect that our screens... Oh, no. I like how this is an interrupted visual text all the time, actually. It's like a... It's not just chaos theory, it's also punctuated catastrophes, really, that go on. It's quite nice. Technology...
Is the audio coming through?
Our audio, so far, is just fine. Yeah, and the image is just fine.
There we go.
So this is small, punctuated catastrophe.
Well, that's a... I think that's a very provocative and interesting way to describe the situation as you've just described it, because as Derrida makes perfectly clear, the idea of logos applies both to a deep sense of order that inheres in the natural world and to language. The ordering power of language and the ordering power of nature or God are aligned in the idea of logos. So what happens then if what one means by logos, or put it differently, what happens if logos is replaced by code? That's a profound displacement of sources of authority, and the connection between nature and language, because now it means that sort of at the very institution of the possibility of rational thought, you've introduced the idea of computation. And if you're to look at that as a kind of teleological trajectory, as certainly people like Wolfram and Fred can do, then our computational era is the logical fulfillment of the possibilities that were there at the very beginning. And that's a really different picture for aligning rational thought, human society, human complexity with natural forces than would traditionally inhere in an idea like logos.
Yeah. And so what happens when a regime of computation, you know, for a recalcitrant postmodernist such as myself, living within the age of computation, which I happen to sort of despise and like at one at the same time, you know, find themselves, you know, really paying attention to someone like Paul Virilio saying that the regime of computation, like any technology, always contains, it's born with its accident in place. And its accident is in fact that it lacks symbolic exchange. It can't ever recover or renew itself in terms of its immanent principles itself. And I notice, like in your texts, which are so eloquent, that you implicitly have found in fact a solution to this, which is epistemological and eschatological. It's in fact your constant reversion to, you know, a fantastic literature of which you are such an eloquent, you provide such eloquent descriptions. I'm thinking of like Bernard Wolff's Limbo, you know, these grisly images of image of a future of auto amputations and prosthetics, or your really, you know, elegiac descriptions of House of Leaves, which is such a wonderful text itself. And they thought, well, Catherine really is found in the embodied text of literature itself, a form of symbolic exchange by which to renew the otherwise, the otherwise dying systems of the regime of computation. Of course, to say that's an entirely unfair question.
I'm not sure I could agree that the systems of computation are dying, but leaving aside that question, in the conclusion of My Mother Was a Computer, I arrived at a formulation that for me speaks to your question. And that formulation is this, that what we make and what, in parentheses, we think we are co-evolved together. And what that suggests to me is a point that Donna Haraway has spoken very and written very eloquently about, and that is that we construct the worlds in which we live in both metaphoric and literal senses, and we therefore have responsibility for the kind of constructions that we make. And so computation is sort of the newest gorilla on the scene of human technologies. But the idea that technologies have a formative influence on who we are biologically, physically, socially, psychologically, and as embodied subjects goes back to the Paleolithic era and before. And it implies that there are always more than, there are many ways to explain the world. The ways that we choose to explain the world have material effects on who we are. And therefore, we ought to think very carefully and evaluate very carefully about which models we want to ascribe authority to. And My Mother Was a Computer is not meant as a polemic endorsing the regime of computation.
No.
Its claim is simply that this is a major idea that needs to be interrogated. And that was the purpose of my project, to interrogate this idea with a view to evaluating what are its implications for us as embodied human subjects.
Yeah, that's great. And you have, in fact, like a really creative and transformative vision of computation itself. I mean, in your hands and in your mind, concepts like distributed cognition and neural networking, that were the splice, not simply the metaphor, really come alive for purposes of the creative human imagination and human solidarity itself. It's the creative direction of technology itself. And you so eloquently work out the theory of intermediation and the groundwork for a new materialism. So, you know, take all of that for granted, really recognize the wonderful value of that. But at the same time, you just have this, like, I don't know, maybe it's skepticism. It's a good old intellectual virtue, which is to say, well, putting that aside and thinking of the regime of computation, well, what happens to, in fact, like the contemporary world, which seems to be breaking in upon it? And just the events of the day, which are so pressing, the emergence of forms of religious fundamentalism, really extremist ideologies, the bunkering down of the liberal human subject. In fact, the resurrection of the liberal human subject in the form of those white all-male posses in the borders with Mexico trying to keep immigrants out of the United States and things like this. It just seems that there are these equivalent forces in the world, that there's been a resurrection effect of very primitive forms of behavior, of political behavior, at the same time that culture is transcendent technologically.
Well, in my view, of course, these are very contentious political subjects, but in my view, many of these developments can be understood as a backlash against increasing complexity. As the world, our technologies, and human societies themselves become more complex, one possible reaction to that is to want to simplify that, to look for simple answers, reassuring convictions that can be maintained true at all times and in all places. And I think fundamentalism, whether of the Islamic variety, the Christian variety, or other varieties, thrives on the desire to find simple verities that can always be true, into which one can place kind of unqualified belief. The positive value of the regime of computation, in my view, is that it offers another view about the complexity of these dynamics. Now, of course, that technology can be appropriated for simplistic purposes and simplistic ideological programs. But the thrust of these dynamics is to show that there's now a way to begin to think through complexity. I'm sure Newton thought the world was complex as well, but he did not have the technology in order to deal with it. We do now have some of that technology at least, and that's the great positive value of something like the regime of computation. I should also say I myself feel intensely ambivalent about something like the regime of computation because I can see perfectly well all of its pernicious aspects as well. But my task is to try to find how it can be transformative in a positive sense. And that, I think, is its really important contribution.
Yeah. So that's great. So I wonder if we could talk about complexity and how, in fact, you've made things, you know, really try to bring out the creative edge, you know, the interpolations within complexity itself, like in Writing Machines, for example, in which, you know, you really have developed like really such a new and originally compelling theory of the relationships between digital subjects and literary texts itself, and the notion of writing machines itself. And I wonder if you could just talk about the relationship between what is to be found that is really creative and singular in the issue of electronic textuality itself. And you just sort of switching gears here, because you know the background of this, of course, is you know the fateful discussion, as you call, the bathtub theory of literature. You know, you can't read electronic text in your bathtub, so, which I did say when we were starting C theory, that was exactly it. But anyway, I said, well, Catherine's really articulated this very well, because we ran into exactly the same thing. We were moving from a print journal to an electronic journal. Everybody said to us, well, I can't read the net in my bathtub, so what the use is that? So, as you said, you reply to that very nicely. You say, well, that's, you know, really, it strikes me from a point of view, literary criticism, that's really a relatively crude way of understanding the history of the book itself. And so, therefore, you begin to open up electronic text, issues of electronic textuality. So, it just strikes me like Writing Machines, both in its design and what you say in the book, is itself such a wonderful example of, you know, description which is materialist, which is about intermediation. I wonder if you could just talk about that in this case.
Well, Writing Machines was meant to be an embodied argument. And it was a visual-verbal collaboration between Ann Burdick, a print designer, and also a media designer, and myself. And so the book artifactual nature is crucial to understanding what the book is about. So it has a verbal argument in it, but at every point that verbal argument is in conversation with its materiality.
Yeah.
And since it is a conversation, the materiality doesn't just illustrate those concepts, it sometimes is in active tension or even disagreement with those concepts. But that's sort of crucial to say at the outset. And so its existence as a print book is very important. But in that print book, I'm also arguing that print is now so thoroughly interpenetrated with electronic textuality that print should more properly be considered an output form of electronic text than something entirely different. So once again, I'm interested both in the specific materiality of the medium, but also the ecological relationships in which that medium exists. So my purpose there was to try to show how medium-specific analysis could be practiced in three different media. I talk about House of Leaves, a popular best-selling print, experimental print novel, Talon Mehmet's Lexia to Perplexia, wonderful electronic work, and the Humyament, Tom Phillips artist book. So there's three different sort of material instantiations in play there. But equally important to me are the ecological relationships that are informing each of those material instantiations as well. And in fact, we could not have produced writing machines as a print text without the computer, because every time I use a quotation, for example, it's imaged as it's actually imaged in the original text. It's not continuous TypeScript. And meant every page on which a quotation appears, which is most of the pages of the book, had to be hand-designed on the computer. It couldn't just run continuously, or it wouldn't have come out looking right on the page. So there was a lot of craft work involved in that, and also a lot of intermediation working between the computer and the print text.
Yeah. So would you see that as, in some ways, your work is like a successor of Marshall McLuhan's, in a sense? Because McLuhan, was just... He was just so creatively interested in the future of the book, and he was also, like The Medium as Massage, for example, does something similar.
Yes.
It just explodes at a very, with no computer.
Yes.
At hand.
In fact, when we were talking about predecessors for this book, The Medium as the Massage was one of the predecessors that we were looking at very carefully, thinking about McLuhan and how one could deal innovatively with this conversation between design and text.
And so, do you think also, if I could just ask one other McLuhan-related question, that McLuhan had this notion of, like, you have a theory of the novel and the regime of computation, which is really about embodied text involving concepts like methods, like intermediation, which is pay attention also to the stories we tell and relations that we're involved in addition to questions of pure virtuality itself. It's the basis for an immaterialism itself. And McLuhan's equivalent to that would be the laws of the tetrad, the four laws of any media, that it simultaneously does something new, recovers something old, hides, in fact, its the invisibility and the power of the medium in terms of its actual contents itself, and then sometimes can be found in displaced forms. Would you think that your turn to novels is in fact following like McLuhan's logic of tetrads in some sense? That you're disguising something entirely new that you're saying by repositioning the novel itself, by this real succession of really fabulous literature that you go through, as recovering it for a new purpose, and paying particular attention to books which you think, in fact, represent in print form the history of digitality.
Well, I'm very interested in that question, and I'm embarking now on a project looking at the interaction of narrative and database, which is exactly along the lines that you're describing. That is, the idea that data, as Lev Manovich has said, is now a dominant cultural form, and it's certainly a presence that's affecting contemporary artists' ideas about how to tell narrative. But at the same time, databases themselves are riddled with narrative practices. Both at the user end, when data is being described to tell a story, as when Alan Greenspan is telling the story of the Federal Reserve massive data analysis, but also at the front end, in database management textbooks, where the authors are speaking to the next generation of students learning to be database managers, those too are riddled with narratives. And so narrative practice is in constant interplay with data streams, data analysis, databases, and that's precisely the dynamics that my new project will be looking at.
Oh, that's really phenomenal. So this would really be to look at code as artifice then?
Yes, I suppose you could say it that way, although it is also looking at code as the implementation of massive amounts of data in databases, and the implications of using code technology to arrive at a new stage of data analysis.
Yeah, but in My Mother Was a Computer, as well as in Writing Machines, you talk of code, you say, well, really when you approach the history of code, drop like systemic descriptions which are simply bound within science, and why don't we begin to think of code as writing? And
yes,
thus begin to think of its forms of life outlets.
Yes, I believe that code should be approached as a language system, And that was part of the argument in My Mother Was a Computer, in suggesting a comparative cross-analysis between different kinds of language systems.
Yeah. And so would the novels themselves that you treat be exemplary of different language systems, like really creative explorations of different language systems? The difference between, for example, Borges dreaming students into existence and then the realization that the dreamer is being dreamed into existence, as opposed to Bernard Wolff's Limbo and The House of Leaves, etc.
Yeah, I think that that's true. I think that contemporary novels are deeply interpenetrated by ideas of code, both in their material existence, but also in their artistry. And as code becomes more and more essential to the production of print text, print authors, like authors in the digital environment, are beginning to engage in a complex dynamic between language and code, in which they both resist code and they embrace it. And this kind of complexity, I think, is explanatory of a lot of experimental work in the present, House of Leaves being one example.
Okay. But when you, and that's really great. Now, could you just press a little bit further? Because there's like a tension in your work between that, you know, kind of really eloquent reading of narratologue, the systems of narrative itself into the language of code, and really thinking of code in terms of the rules of writing itself, writing machines. And on the other hand, your really astute observations on, well, what exactly are the properties of code? And one author that comes up, you know, again and again in your work is Alexander Galloway, and Lev Manovich, of course, but Alexander Galloway, when he says, you know, code is different, really, than writing, because code is different than speech, for sure, because code is always performative, and code is always executable. You follow your reflections on Alexander Galloway's notion of code as executable by saying, in fact, the implication of this is that code is intended to, you know, give commands for machines to run on software systems itself. So I thought, well, that really introduces like a boundary into the language of code once more. It's a little bit of a liberal human subjectivity, which is writing into the language of code. Antonia, I'm sure.
Not sure how that follows. I was following you right up till the last sentence.
Well, I was trying to sneak this in. Well, it just struck me that when you quote Alexander Galloway, a writer who theorized immensely.
I got all that part, just the last sentence.
Well, when you go to the, when you quote Galloway on code, that code is executable. And this in the context of your description of speech and writing. Code is executable. It seems that you're into a language of positivism. In fact, I wouldn't even say positivism much more. I'd say it's hyper-positivism. Because this is, in fact, a quality of writing, in fact, that it's not always performative, that writing is always about its aporias and about its invisibilities, about what's not said. Like, for example, a novel like The Movement of Movement from Snow Crash to Cryptomicon. Under your influence, I went back and I read both novels again in getting ready for this interview. And, you know, Snow Crash, of course, you know, always, you know, I'm obsessed with it. But Cryptomicon, I've always been really disappointed with. Because I thought, well, Cryptomicon, you know, is really about a collapse of a certain really creative aporia in writing itself, which was Snow Crash in some ways.
Well, of course, as a literary critic, I would absolutely agree with you about the gaps, the silences, the fissures in writing being an essential part of literary craft, openings in texts in which readers can put their own interpretations and so forth. At the same time, the shift to digital environments has introduced a new consideration that doesn't quite obtain in those older legacy systems, and that's the notion of building. And when you put together source code, you're actually building something, and when you run it on the computer, you see if that building is gonna stand up or fall down. And that kind of notion that you're building something, it works or it doesn't work, is not quite the same. In fact, you could even say it's in blatant contradiction with the notion of Fisher and aporia being intrinsic to writing. So it suggests that writing in digital media is introducing a new kind of consideration, which can be then put into complex interplay with this notion of Fisher's gaps and silences and so forth. So you can have work like Jody's, which builds web pages essentially designed to fail. That's part of their aesthetic. Or you can have complex interplays between silence and production in texts like Cryptonomicon. But I would simply say that I think it's an unwarranted assumption to say that the gap in the fissure has more authority than the notion of building if we're talking about productions in digital media. I think that one is based on a natural language system, a human-only language system. The other is based on code. And so one of the things that code is doing when it's put in juxtaposition with language is forcing a dialogue between this notion of the gap and the notion of the building. And so I don't think at the outset we can say building is bad, it's positivist, it's retrogressive, the gap is good, it's productive, it's creative, because it's precisely the tension between those two that is at issue. And if we prejudge that, which in literary studies I think is frequently done, the effect is to blind us to the nature of this interplay and to the power that code has. It's to misread digital productions as print productions.
A great, great reply. And so can I just follow that by asking, well, in that case, with this notion of code as about, you know, about source codes and assembler codes on the one hand, at the same time, you know, really hypersensitive to fissures and gaps, do you think really that this would mean, in terms of its implications for complex human subjectivity that you so eloquently described, that complex human subjectivity itself is a logic, as Judith Butler would say, is a logic conclusion, assembler codes and source codes on one hand, and the logic exclusion. And they're not opposite one another, they're deeply entwined one with the other.
I think that's right, because we're all aware, of course, through the work of Freud, Butler, you can trace almost a lineage from the late 19th century to the present, of the ways in which human consciousness, human subjectivity is in interplay with things that we don't know, that we don't realize, that are gaps or fissures in our understandings. And yet, in some sense, human consciousness works. That is, it's running on some platform. We're not sure exactly what, but it is running on a platform. Yeah. And it is productive of an understanding of the world. And so at the same time that there are all these gaps and fissures, there's also in the production of human consciousness itself this building aspect that I was talking about. So obviously those are both in dynamic interaction with one another in human subjectivity as in the world in general.
Well, that's great. So that would come back to then your notion of the post-human subject, or even the subject of complex human subjectivities. And just as putting, like, from have we ever been post-human, which you, such a wonderful thing to say. You say, where I think at that point we seem to develop a new key, Gregory Bateson's notion, that randomness is what exists outside the box in which the system is located. Your discussions about poiesis and emergence arise. You have such an eloquent statement after that. You said, what's needed is a new way of understanding that, quote, the larger and unknowable complexity for which the perceptual processes of an organism are a metaphor, these organisms that will survive desperately will have internal structures that are good metaphors for the complexity without. So then the post-human, not, it's not anti-human, it's not apocalyptic, but it's about something else. And I don't want to be long-winded, but if you don't mind, if I could just quote you, because I think it's just such a wonderful way of living construction. You said, the construction of another kind of account, emergence replaces teleology, reflexive epistemology replaces objectivism, distributed cognition replaces autonomous will, embodiment replaces a body seen as a support system for the mind, and a complex partnership between humans and intelligent machines replaces liberal humanist desire to control and conquer. Well, when I read those comments from the How We Became Posthuman, I thought, well, this is like really a manifesto for a new mode of being. I think Heidegger would have smiled for it.
Well, thank you. That's a very eloquent way to put it. But I guess what this conversation is revealing to me is that this idea of complexity really could be seen at the heart of all three of those books.
I think so. So, Catherine, I think we're almost running out of time, and I want to thank you. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you would like to comment on? It's always it's a job interview question. You know?
What's your library like?
Pretty good.
Thank you very much. I very much appreciate this opportunity to talk with you and to hear your own thoughts on this, and you're very generous embracing of a lot of the ideas that I have advanced. Thank you. It's been a wonderful experience.
Yes, thank you for this, and also thank you for writing such wonderful books. That's great.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Okay.